It'll probably tell me I have the brain of an 80-year-old or something. The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 323, recorded on September 2nd, 2013. Welcome to the 323rd edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and 156th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
And I am Jordan Lund.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and gives a gaming history. And finally, we'll be probably doing this gaming history unless we have too much to talk about. I mean, there's a lot of news because PAX Prime was this weekend.
PAX Prime was this weekend, yes.
Yes, and you decided to buy some scalp tickets for Sunday.
I was able to get in on Sunday. It was a tough road since my wife had to work on Saturday and we both had to work today. So it was a quick up and back.
Yeah. So what did you get to do there? What stood out for you?
What stood out for me? I can't really say that anything stood out for me. I mean, most of it was all stuff that we're aware of that's coming for the fall. There wasn't really any surprises. I think probably the biggest surprise was how poor Sega's booth was. Sega had three games total, and that was pretty much it. You know, they've got the new Sonic game, they have the Mickey Mouse game, and they have some Japanese game that I hadn't heard of before.
The Mickey Mouse game is pretty good. I played it at E3, and it actually translated well. You know, a lot of people are complaining about the bad controls in DuckTales Remastered, but the Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusions is actually pretty solid.
I was just surprised at that they only brought three games. You know, on their website they said that they were going to have Phantasy Star Online 2, and I asked about that, and they said, you know, actually that we had that last year, and I said, oh great, so you haven't updated your website in a year. That speaks a whole lot.
The biggest game there was Titanfall. From what I understand, they had 2-hour lines for that.
Titanfall, Microsoft's booth was basically three games. They had Titanfall, Battlefield 4, and Forza. And eight or 10 stations of each. Forza 3, slightly less than the other two. The lines to play those were fairly extensive. Yeah. Microsoft really is pinning a lot of the success of the Xbox One on EA. And so EA and Microsoft were both there in heavy presence.
Microsoft knows that they just need something to bide people over until Halo comes. And by the way, they finally called it Halo 5. Remember the teaser at E3?
I saw that. Halo? Yeah, at E3 they just said Halo, and now they've actually appended the 5 onto it.
And the thing is, that's not a small thing, because if you notice, a lot of people have been doing that. Like Thief 4 is now Thief. Dragon Age 3 Inquisition is now Dragon Age Inquisition. Killzone 4 is Killzone Shadowfall. You know, it's sort of like people don't think people are going to get it. You know, it's sort of like the Madness of King George. They didn't call it the Madness of King George III because they were afraid people might think it was a sequel.
Exactly.
You know?
And the most of the other stuff was pretty much as I expected. I did get hands-on with the PS4, which is good. I sat through the session for Watch Dogs, which... more or less is the same thing you've seen on all the YouTube videos. The one surprise out of the show was the Assassin's Creed 4 presentation. I wasn't aware that Assassin's Creed 4 was going to have entire underwater levels. There's a diving bell, and you can use the diving bell to search underwater wrecks for gold and other things, which I had no clue that there was a whole underwater component to that game with sharks and moray eels and all of that stuff too. So that was kind of interesting.
You know, it's really looking good, even better than I thought, because I approached this game with sort of skepticism that I thought, oh, it's pretty cool, but now it's looking really, really fantastic, and I'm now really looking forward to it, and that's Batman Arkham Origins.
Batman Arkham Origins could be a good game.
You're actually going through Gotham, right? And you're stopping crimes like Batman, you know, and they have all these mini games. And you're also dealing with Anarchy, you know, that character from the comics as well.
Right, right.
And I'm just saying, it's much better than I would have thought it would be. And if you remember, it's not being developed by Rocksteady. It's being developed by someone else.
I enjoyed the first two games. I can't say that I recall actually finishing either of the first two games.
Oh, you didn't... Then you know what happens at the end of Arkham City, right?
I can't say that I recall. I don't remember.
That's one of the most guarded spoilers. People don't like to spoil that because it's such a shocking ending. So you have to finish it just to experience the ending. And while you're doing it, sit through the credits because they have a bonus during the credits. That's kind of touching.
Gotcha.
So anyways, we're going to move on to our first news item. And speaking of PAX Prime, you know, the big surprise was before PAX Prime. So take it away, Jordan.
Game news. Nintendo announces 2DS Wii U price drop from NBC News. Wow, we're getting stuff from NBC News now. That's
well,
nice.
Well, you know what? I couldn't find it on Strategy Informer because we don't cover Nintendo stuff. So I just did a search and just went with the biggest site I could find, and that was NBC. Gotcha.
Nintendo took gamers by surprise last Wednesday, when it suddenly announced plans to release a new handheld gaming console on October 12th, a little more than a month before rival console developers Sony and Microsoft put their next generation systems on the market. Nintendo said that the 2DS will be compatible with all 3DS games, but will be different from its current reigning champion in a few key ways. At $129, it's a good $50 cheaper than the 3DS, but as the new system's name suggests, it will not support the same three-dimensional visual effects that the 3DS has. And while the 2DS still have the DS's iconic 2D screen display, Nintendo has tweaked the form factor of the 2DS to make it a flat, slate-like tablet that can't bend like its predecessors. Nintendo of America's president, Reggie Fils-Aimé,
said... He's a man. Come on. We said his name tons before. Reggie Fils-Aimé
said the point of the 2DS was to make a more family-friendly, cost-effective model for children to start out with, calling it, quote, an entry-level handheld gaming system. Nintendo also announced a $50 price drop for the Wii U, which will bring the console's price down to $299.99 starting September 20th.
You know, when they say an entry-level and family, and it's not a clamshell design, you know what they're really saying? We want something that breaks so that parents have to get new ones every few months. Because that's what, well, this thing is going to break.
One other thing they're doing with the 2DS is that, you know, it's the plastic cover makes it look like it's two separate screens. It's not. It's actually one single screen that's beveled off with the plastic of the top cover.
So, you know, a lot of people like this idea. I don't. And it's obviously because this is not something you can put in your pocket like you can the 3DS or the DS, you know, lacking the clamshell design. I mean, I don't care about the 3D, you know, and it's sort of like...
One of the best analyses that I saw of it said that basically Nintendo is experimenting with the whole tablet design, and that this is not just an entry level handheld gaming console; it's an entry level tablet for kids. I think it's a terrible idea. I think there's a lot of 3DS games that require a 3D component in order to complete the game, so you're going to be locking out all of those games from effectively being played on this machine. And you know what's going to happen. Furthermore, is just like the DS and DS Lite and 3DS were replaced by XL versions. Come next year, you'll have an XL version of this as well.
What, the Nintendo iPad? The thing is that, you know, Nintendo is not doing what people want them to do. And if you're going to do something for tablets, just release your games on iPhone and Android. Come on. iOS, Android, do it. That's what people want from Nintendo. Nintendo's steadfastly refusing to do that. I mean, wouldn't you play... a Pokemon game, say, well, not you personally, but I just mean the Royal Wii here. Wouldn't we rather play Pokemon on an iOS smartphone than on 3DS?
I think there's a tremendous audience there. If they made all of the old Pokemon games available for iOS, I think that would be a huge deal.
Well, they have Pokemon XY coming, right? So, you know, it's just, I mean, I'm also shocked that people haven't created, well, they have. I mean, Monster Hunter is basically for Pokemon for when the kids grow up. You know, and they get bored of the same gameplay over and over and over again. But I don't know. I still have a DS. You know, I have a big fat DS, not the small one, but the clumsy large DS. And I haven't charged it in a while either. I haven't had a reason to use it in a while, actually.
I have a DS Lite, and I just haven't seen any reason to throw more money at Nintendo.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I wonder what will happen if I visit Brain Age now and they see how much time has passed by. Is he gonna? I can't believe. I wonder how it's gonna scold me for 2 years not training my brain. It'll probably tell me I have the brain of an 80-year-old or something. Anyways, we're gonna move on to the next item. Inafune, quote unquote, fought hard for risk taking at Capcom, saying creators must be, quote-unquote, willing to fail. And this comes to us from Now Gamer. as opposed to now Voyager. Keiji Inafune, formerly of Capcom, who's best known for, by the way, the Mega Man titles, among other, you know, things, but, you know, he's huge, right? Now runs his own independent studio Concept. Whilst at Capcom, he, quote, fought hard for people to be creative, unquote. Despite pushing for riskier projects, Inafune-san believes Inafune believes that he was rather numb compared to going it alone now at Concept, which he, quote unquote, lives or dies in how they run it. He says, when I was at Capcom, I fought hard for people to be creative and take risks, but within a larger organization, you sometimes get numb at taking those risks. You sort of project it by the organization. When I was at Capcom, I felt I was the one of the ones. Jordan, move that out of the way. You sort of project it by the organization. When I was at Capcom, I felt I was one of the ones fighting to take those risks and that I wasn't numb to the fact that we needed to do that. But going independent and starting my own company, I realized that I was still somewhat numb when I was at... this is the same quote over again. So don't blame me, folks. Starting my own company, I have all of that risk. My company lives or dies on how we start the company, the creative ideas, and the games we create. I realized going independent just how sensitive I would be and how much more it takes to really push to take those risks and what those risks actually mean to the company itself. Concept has launched a Kickstarter campaign for Mighty Number 9, which is the spiritual successor to Mega Man. In just over 24 hours, the crowdfunding drive raised its $900,000 goal. I find this bizarrely ironic because he's talking about taking risks, right? So what's the one game that he decides to push to people? Oh, look, it's another version of Mega Man. The game that you just created 10 versions of over the past 20 years, that's really taking a risk, guy?
I would say that Capcom in general... Well, it's not fair to point the finger at Capcom, but any company that needs to make money is not going to take risks.
But what you know, the thing about that is Capcom does take risks. I mean, I don't know what Inafune is talking about. Maybe I think, you know, the reason is, I know they do a lot of Street Fighter, but you know what? Don't they also do Lost Planet, which was a big risk, or Lost Planet was one big risk.
Lost Planet was like Dead years ago now, though.
But Dead Rising, you know, Devil May Cry, Dragon's Dogma. I mean, these are all risks, right?
Dragon's Dogma was risky, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not like they've been sitting on the same IPs. I mean, well, I don't know if this is a risk, but World Gone Sour. that's the Sour Patch Kids game. Anyways, but the thing is that Inafune says he wants to take risks, but what risk is he taking with Mighty Number 9?
That's true, and it seems to be, you know, more Mega Man type action.
Oh crap, I just remembered. Let me ask you if this is a risk, okay? Steel Battalion.
Steel Battalion was a huge risk, but that was also what, in 2004?
Yeah, but he's basically saying that Capcom's done nothing but, you know, I don't think he's talking about presently. I think he's just talking about in general.
Well, if you look at since the launch of the current generation, Capcom really has not done an awful lot that has been really genre breaking or, let me think. There was one game that might have been from them. Let me just confirm it before I go off on a tangent.
Well, I mean, yes, they've been going with a lot of their old titles, you know, for PlayStation Network and Xbox Live Arcade, but that's what you do. You know, but Dragon's Dogma isn't that old. It's 2008, no?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not, you know, I mean, Killer 7.
I thought they were behind Mad World. They were not behind Mad World. Sorry, that was Sega. No.
They were behind Killer 7, which is another weird cel-shaded, batshit insane game. The Suda games.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but in a weird way, Suda does the same thing over and over and over too. You know, he always does the same batshit crazy stuff, and just Akami, right? That was. But then again, by going by your thing, that's in the early 2000s, so I guess that doesn't count. Yeah.
I would say if it's not in the current generation, it's a matter of what have you done lately.
Well, wouldn't you consider the Wii the current generation? Oh wait, no wait.
Wii is not
Akami,
current generation.
Akami,
not
Akami,
anymore.
Started on the PS2, didn't it?
Akami started on the PS2, yes.
Oh, okay. But it was on the Wii. And, mm-hmm. But no, I mean, when we say current generation, the Wii is part of the current generation. What are you talking about?
I mean, well, the Wii has already been replaced by the Wii U.
Yeah, I know. But what I'm saying is that when you say the current generation, we're talking about PS3, Xbox 360, right? The Wii is more associated with that than the Wii U is. I mean,
well, I would say yes in that sense.
I'm talking about technology because the Wii U is more akin to the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3. Maybe a little bit actually worse than them. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead.
GOTUS beta to hit Steam early access on 13th of September. This comes to us from PC Gamer. Peter Molyneux's new take on the God game, GOTUS, will soon be hitting beta stage, and gamers will be able to play it through Steam early access on the 13th of September 2013. The developer announced that he is, quote, proud and delighted that the beta version GOTUS will be available for download on 13th September 2013. For a long time, I've been excited with how the game is evolving. I already feel there is nothing in the world like GOTUS. This is the type of game I have dreamt of making since first getting into the industry. Having people play the beta and give us valuable feedback while doing so makes that dream a reality. As usual with Steam Early Access, gamers can effectively pre-order the game by paying £19.99, £14.99 or €18.99 and getting early access to the beta. In exchange, players can give feedback to the developer as functioning beta testers.
No, wait, I have to take some issue. The game wasn't evolving. It was intelligent design, wasn't it?
I would hope it would be.
Especially for a game named Goddess. And by the way, for those who don't know Goddesses, it's basically the 21st century populace, basically. And it looks beautiful. The thing is that, you know, one thing I laugh at is that when he says he dreamt of this when first getting into the industry and having people play the beta and give them valuable feedback, isn't that what external beta testers did for decades before the internet ruined everything? I mean, didn't...
I find it interesting that people are now paying for the right to be a beta tester.
Well,
it used to be the other way around. We would pay you to be a beta tester. Now it's the other way around.
Well, actually, you know, it's not quite that because basically there's a pre-order, you know, and I don't mind pre-ordering a game and then getting to immediately play it, you know, or at least some version of it. I mean, you do it with the understanding that it's not finished, right? And, you know, It's active pre-ordering to me because you know how it is when sometimes it used to be when you pre-ordered, say, Civilization 2, right? I waited for months dreaming about playing it, right? Well, now, you know, you don't have to wait. You can just play it in an early form and help make it, you know? I mean, yeah, it sounds like you're like, you know, it's paid beta. But you know what? Any sort of external beta testing, I'm A-OK with, you know, because they're making their money and people have already bought it. So they haven't invested. They have an investment, literally, in making this game the best it can be, you know? And you're still doing the same risks as with any pre-order. And now, if you complain that the game's broken, you can say, well, it's your fault, isn't it? Because you didn't tell them what was wrong with the game.
Call me old-fashioned, but nobody should pay money to play an unfinished game.
But you see, the thing is that one of the advantages of this is that by pre-ordering it, it's not going to be forced out the door. Because there's no pressure to have, you know, to release it on that day.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
I'm just saying if a company wants to do real beta testing, honest beta testing, they need to do it the proper way and not, you know, get people to fish in money first. That just is wrong to me.
Well, sometimes this is the other thing, though, about Steam early access. Sometimes it's a good way for the developer to get an infusion of cash to finish their product. I mean, remember the Broken Age, which was the Double Fine Adventure. Tim Schafer discovered that he wasn't going to have enough money to finish the game despite all the millions that he got, which is slightly hilarious on my part, or at least tragic, right? So they're gonna Steam early access it so that they can finish the game, right? I mean, it's no different than Kickstarter, really, if you want to think about it.
That's true.
You know? And like I said, you know, I'm there's a good chance I'm going to – this will be my first Steam early access. Now, do you have fond memories of Populous?
No, I never liked Populous.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
I find sim games to be incredibly boring, and Populous is very much a sim game.
What about From Dust, that Ubisoft game in which it's sort of like Populous, but not really?
Never looked at it.
Oh, okay.
So I like I said, I'm not interested in that kind of game. They bore me silly, so I don't bother with them.
Okay, well, here's the next item. Take it away.
Diablo 3's new loot system, quote, to cut the legs out from the auction house, from PC Gamer. The announced Reaper of Souls expansion for Diablo 3 will be joined by a major update for all players, which overhauls the loot system in the action RPG to get things focused back on the game itself. Blizzard wants to end the auction house first, play game second mentality that they caused. The solution will be a smart drop item and reducing loot levels overall. They acknowledge there's a sugar high from buying items in the auction house because the instant gratification, but too many focus on it over just playing the game. Lead content designer Kevin Martin said it's not the core fantasy. It's the most fun, and by the end game, that for a variety of reasons, they tend to check the auction house first and play the game second. That's not what we intend, and we do want to address that. So the loot system and the enchanting and crafting systems are both intended to cut the legs out from the auction house to make it unnecessary to go on to some degree when the most fun or where the most fun to play the game becomes the best way to play the game. Gosh, who would have thought playing the game is the best way to play the game? The announcement of an auction house for Diablo 3 was met with contention from the community, fearing a World of Warcraft economy emerging, particularly with real money purchases. Detractors weren't far off the mark. These new smart drop items dropping from monsters, bosses, and chests will be better tuned to your current character. Blizzard are also stemming the tide of rubbish items that serve only to clutter up the inventories or make a mess of the floor. Legendaries will be increased in their number with greater array of effects. A new artisan, the Mystic, will be introduced that transmutes items, transferring stats from one to another.
I'm just trying to figure out what they thought was going to happen when they included the auction house in the first place. I mean, did they not understand what the auction house would do, especially if you had a real money auction house? What did they expect would happen? People use the auction house.
Well, the reason they did it was to give an excuse for their online only DRM, which is why they did it.
No. They could have done that in other ways. No, the reason for the auction house is because when you had the real money auction house, Blizzard would take a cut of all the sales. That was the reason, not necessarily have an always on DRM. I mean, they could have done that without the auction house. In this case, it was because they wanted to make more money and do it in the short term, and then realize that people like me would play for like a week and stop playing because I shockingly lost interest in Diablo 3. And the thing is that I still play Diablo 2, which is a bad sign, you know.
Well, I think this is probably also a necessary step when bringing Diablo 3 to consoles, because the auction house was not going to work on consoles.
Well, for one thing, the console versions are going to be offline as well.
Right.
Or at least have an offline component, which still is bugging the heck out of PC gamers, because they still can't. And they can't use LANs either, from what I understand. Their own private thing. They have to go on Battle.net. So, I don't know. This is like, you know, this is the sort of thing that we go under the term executive meddling, because I cannot imagine any of the developers wanted having an auction house in a game that wasn't an MMO. Because
I agree. It was a terrible idea. The whole thing from the beginning was a disaster. Not as big a disaster as the new SimCity game, but it was a fairly big disaster.
Well, here's the thing. You know, an MMO, by its very nature, you a lot of people just hang around and do nothing, you know, because that's an MMO. Right. In a role-playing game, an action RPG, which is basically a roguelike, you don't want people sitting around doing nothing and waiting to buy items from the auction house, you know? Because now, you know, you no longer have to grind for that item. It's just right there. You don't have to do anything, you know?
Right.
So it's hilarious how Jay Wilson went overboard and criticizing that guy who helped develop, you know, Diablo 2, you know, and essentially Jay Wilson, after he's gone from that, said, yeah, we may have made a mistake there. You think? I don't know.
I find it interesting how many of these companies are making critical errors. They're not listening to gamers when gamers tell them, no, that's a bad idea. And then after it all blows up in their face, they go, oh, yeah, I guess they were all right, huh?
I don't care what gamers think, okay? I don't want a gamer developing a game. I care about what the developers think. And I'm going to tell you right now, I'm willing to bet you the developers did not want to have the auction house.
Well, I'm sure they didn't. And but, you know, when you have a massive outcry from your audience, that is something that needs to be taken into account. And we're seeing time and time again with things like Diablo and SimCity and the Xbox One. What happens when it does happen and when it doesn't happen?
Well, you see, a lot of times it's not revealed until like a month or two before the game is released, right?
Right.
I mean, Microsoft certainly listened to fan outcry. You know, this is not going
to
work.
They had to. Yeah, they had no choice.
Well, they did have a choice. They just made the choice that would actually sell the console.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, you can make choices. There are good choices and there are bad choices.
Yeah. If they wanted a console failure, by all means, keep listening to Don Matrick.
Yeah, and you know what? The Nintendo 2DS is no choice at all. I mean, that's the worst choice of all. Not making any choice. Just saying, you know what? We're just going to make another form of our console.
I just wanted to grab Nintendo and shake them and go, you already had a 2DS. It was called the DS.
Yeah. You know, actually, now that I think about it, it's sort of like someone saying, well, you know what? We took the entire 2D concept, but check this out. We made it so that you don't need glasses and everything appears as a painting in front of you instead of jabbing at your eyes. Now it's on a nice single plane. You mean it's in 2D? Yes, it's 2D. It's revolutionary thinking. It's retro. Just like Jack Tretton said that removing the rumble
was the last generation feature. Yes.
And then when they brought it back, I said, no, what's old is new again.
Yes.
So, you know, by the way, this week's question of the week is related to that. So that's just a little teaser right there.
Okay.
So, and we're going to move on to the next item. And by the way, this actually segues pretty well. And by the way, it's something that you've talked about a certain MMO that you were talking about as well. Bethesda wants The Elder Scrolls Online available to non-Xbox Live Gold subscribers. And this comes to us from OXM UK. Bethesda wants Xbox One gamers to be able to play The Elder Scrolls Online, which will be a monthly subscription-based MMO, to be playable by non-Xbox Live Gold subscribers. According to the marketing boss, Peter Hines, what's cool about having a subscription model for us is that, firstly, we don't have any gates on the content. The Elder Scrolls is very much a game about going wherever you want to, and if you're randomly running into artificial obstacles where you have to pay, it just doesn't feel right. The other thing is to do with maintaining a team that we can offer super service and put out the content at a very high clip. If you want to do that, you really need to plan for it in advance and also maintain a really large team of people. Hines went on to say, when we say content, we mean meaningful stuff, like new areas of the world, new factions, bigger meteor stuff, not a couple of new weapons or some outfits, though we can do that too. Horse armor. We can do that stuff, plus a lot more stuff that's more Elder Scrolls-y, not trivial. We could do it daily if we just wanted to throw a dagger out the door. We could just say, here's today's update, but that's not what Elder Scrolls is about. The Elder Scrolls Online is due to be released in the spring 2014 on PC, Xbox One, and PlayStation 4. Now, I know that you actually played an MMO on the Xbox. Was it the Xbox or the Xbox 360? In which you didn't require a gold account because it had its own thing.
Yeah, Phantasy Star Universe,
right.
Had its own hunter license. And you bought the hunter license. You didn't have to have gold, and you could play regardless because you're already paying Sega.
Now, Microsoft did say that they were going to go on a case-by-case basis with this, right? So the Elder Scrolls Online is going to be pretty huge. Sony has already said that people won't need a PSN Plus subscription to play it. So you can be pretty well sure that Microsoft's not going to require a Xbox Live Gold account to play this.
Well, and that only makes sense because you're already paying a fee, right? You pay one fee or pay another fee. You shouldn't have to pay both.
So what's probably going to happen is that Microsoft and Sony are going to get a tiny little cut of the subscription fee.
There's probably something like that, yeah.
Now, the other thing is this. I forgot where I was going to go with this. Oh, yeah. I was actually complaining about this, about one of the problems I had with free-to-play MMOs. I think it was either last week or the week before. In which I complain that, you know, sometimes free-to-play MMOs feel a little bit too segmented because you have to give premium people a reason, you know, to be premium, right?
Right.
So it's one of the benefits of having a subscription-based MMO. Yeah, it's right, great that, you know, you can have some MMOs that are free-to-play, but sometimes, you know, you really need a subscription-based MMO so you can have the entire kit and caboodle without people being segregated into two areas or whatever, you know. And I think this is what I predicted about like a year ago, you know, that the standard for major MMOs was that they were going to be subscription-based for like 2 years, and then they would transition to free-to-play after they made back their initial investment.
Well, and I like, too, that they're talking about delivering content, because that's been the problem with a lot of other games, is that you subscribe, and that's great, but there's no reason to keep subscribing. Once you've gone through the game, there's no new content forthcoming, or the content that's coming is weak. And by having a legitimate subscription and decent amount of money coming through, like you said, he can hire a decent team and keep the flow going.
Which is, by the way, what the new update that's coming to Star Wars: The Old Republic is brilliant, is that they're essentially bringing TIE Fighter versus X-Wing versus TIE Fighter to the MMO, and having open space combat a la, you know, freeform PvP, you know, not these, you know, in that game. You do have space missions, but they're sort of railroaded. In this, you have free-form actual space combat, right? And that's what a lot of Star Wars people want to do, because, you know, it's a you're in the stars and you're having a war. That's basically it, you know? So and the thing is that, you know, when did you ever play Star Wars X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, any of the
Yeah. No, well, not X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, but I played the original X-Wing and TIE Fighter games individually before there was an X-Wing versus TIE Fighter.
But in this case, you know, that's basically what they're bringing back. And I think it's a brilliant idea.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see if it's a premium content that only subscribers can get into. Because I think that might be something that people might pay for. You know, and if it has a significant effect on the game world, in which, you know, if your faction wins this many, then you get a bonus, you know, and, you know, certain cosmetic changes are made, you know.
I just thought the Old Republic was well before there was X-Wings and TIE Fighters, though, so I don't know whether
there's no X-Wings and TIE Fighters. No, they have their own ships, but it's basically the same type of game.
Oh, okay.
It's X-Wing versus TIE Fighter without X-Wings and without TIE Fighters.
Okay.
But like I said, you know, the space combat sim is making a comeback, and you know why? Because the fans are demanding it, literally through Kickstarter, and companies are slow to wait a minute. People like space combat sims, really? And Chris Roberts is doing something. I'm just sad that, you know, Wing Commander. Maybe there's too much negativity attached to Wing Commander because of the movie.
The movie was terrible.
Yeah, and maybe that's the reason why we're not getting any more Wing Commanders. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next. So now we're going to move to listener feedback. I believe this is you, Jordan.
Listener feedback from Paolo Predke at Microsoft Points. This makes more sense, doesn't it? I'm not sure what the deal was previously. Did the games cost a different number of points in different regions? Nope. If so, it doesn't make a difference which way you make transactions, but for the customer, it's always easier to think in their native currency rather than some arbitrary points. And if you get some extra dollars when converting, that's even better.
They're all the same. That was the entire point of having script. You know, 800 Microsoft points buys the same thing in every country.
Right,
it's just that, you know, the denominations are different. Now you're going to have your own things. And, you know, I think the euro makes it easier, because if you always notice when you're dealing with euros, the euros and dollars are always the same. It's always the great British pound that's a little bit less.
At Origin Return Policy, are you sure, Jonah, that they will be able to monitor if you played through the game? One would have to read the fine print, probably, and I'm too lazy to do it. They should implement some fail-safes into the user agreement if they don't want the policy to be abused.
Come on. If you go to Steam or Origin, they actually tell you when you click on a game, you've been playing this game for this many hours. That's why I know I've played Civ 5 for 160 hours, because it says it right there.
Anyway, it seems like a good idea to demo games. People will buy them thinking they will return it if they don't like it, but a part of them will be too lazy to do that later. Win some, lose some for EA, but it should result in a net gain. However, this may mean they won't win the Worst Company in America award next year. Well, we'll see.
It's like the Pope, though, you know? Yeah. They'll remain the worst company until there's something drastic happens, and, you know. But
somebody else screws it up, yeah.
Yeah.
At Borderlands on the Vita, yay, I played the first Borderlands on my PS3 and I really liked it. It wasn't as boring as Diablo, although the core mechanic of both games is similar. Kill, get loot, upgrade weapons, rinse and repeat. The second part coming to Vita is great news, and I really hope they add some DLCs to the bundle. Still, it's another non-exclusive game for the Vita, so why even bother, right?
And by the way, I mentioned the new Batman game, you know, that's not part of the consoles, and it's not a main console, and Jordan just dismissed, it was on the 3DS.
Yeah, I'm 3DS port.
But you know what? It's still a Vita game that's its own game. I mean, who cares if it's another handheld port? It's still not on console. I mean, that's the main problem that I would have if I was owning a Vita or a 3DS. I don't care if it's on another handheld console, but if it's just a port from a console like the 360 or the PS3, I don't care because I can play it on my 360 or PS3. You know.
Right. I just see the lack of exclusive games on the Vita as being a problem, because you want people to buy the hardware, and if people all they see are the same games they can play everywhere else, why spend $200?
Does this mean you're not going to buy Batman on the Vita?
I don't know. Maybe I will wait for the reviews and see what they say. If it's like Lego Batman, where they say, you know, it's just a 3DS port, don't bother, I won't bother.
Well, maybe you won't have to buy it. Hint, hint.
Maybe.
Oh, by the way, I was toying with this idea for a giveaway at GameStop. They're selling Bulletstorm 3 for $10. So,
really?
Yes. I was thinking, you know, I don't own it, so
that's pretty desperate, isn't it? I mean, I've been watching the price on Bulletstorm drop like a rock, but I had no idea they hit as low as $3 for $10. That's funny.
But now it's $3 for $10. But the thing is, I'm thinking, you know what? Maybe I'll buy it. I'll buy a 360 version for myself, and I'll just give away an extra 360 and PS3 version on the podcast.
That's funny.
Yeah. I mean, you sort of liked Bulletstorm, right? I mean,
I played the demo. I thought it was cute, but it wasn't worth buying.
Oh, well, now it's really inexpensive.
Yeah, that's funny.
I don't know how
next
much
up,
it is.
Next up, they'll need to do that with Duke Nukem Forever.
And by the way, these are not used copies either. These are all new copies that they're selling.
Yeah, because they have a boatload of them that they can't unload. Yeah.
Well, you know what? I think it would be a nifty giveaway.
The last comment from Paolo Predgate at next gen launch titles. As much as I enjoy indie games, there's one thing that I don't like about the industry moving in that direction. As much as it is, it's simple. I don't need a 1.6 gigahertz 8-core 8 gig of RAM machine to play Limbo. I understand that games are games, and there's a multitude of great games with simple graphics, but that doesn't justify creating a new generation of gaming consoles. Unless there are developers and publishers willing to break the boundaries of what the current gen can support, I don't even see why we need next gen hardware. Hopefully what's happening now means we will get as many AAA titles as before, in addition a slew of amazing indie titles.
Well, here's the thing about the next gen consoles. I mean, it isn't going to be the graphics that are going to set them apart anymore, because we're used to graphics if you've had a PC, and you know, the PS3 and the 360 do pretty good graphics on their own, you know, close to PC, not quite. The capabilities of these next-gen hardware is that they're going to be using x86 architectures, which means, for one, they'll be able to handle online like a PC. So you won't – two, you'll have more things that you can do, you know. So it's more about flexibility, you know. Like one of the big thing about Watch Dogs is that your friends will be able to peek through security cameras and screw around with you and that sort of thing. That you'll be able to do on the PS4 and Xbox One. You won't be able to do that on the PS3 or the Xbox 360. You know, so it's more about flexibility and the amount of data, you know, the amount of stuff that it can deal with. You know, the calculations basically. I mean, that's really what the next gen is. You know, it's making it easier for online, because remember the big thing about the Xbox One is the massive clouds that they're going to be employing on everything. And you know what? Microsoft is starting to figure out that they don't have to justify the cloud with an always online, because developers are finding a lot of ways to utilize that, you know, as an optional thing. You know, oh, by the way, if you want to use the cloud, if you have the cloud, if you're online, we can turn on these extra features. And basically, I think that's what you wanted, Jordan, basically, is that you wanted a value add. You didn't want it to be mandatory, just a value add.
I didn't want any kind of mandatory check-in to play games that I already purchased.
Yeah.
I think my prediction on the cloud is that by the end of 2014, we're going to realize the cloud was full of crap, that there is nothing to the claims about the cloud.
I think it's going to be the opposite, in that the cloud is going to be something that's expected. You know, it's like, oh, you can multitask, big whoop. You know, it's sort of – because I remember the Atom's big thing, the Coleco Atom – or no, it was the Amiga. I'm sorry. The big thing about the Amiga, remember, was that, oh my God, it can multitask.
Yes.
It can do more than one thing at once.
True preemptive multitasking.
Well, guess what? No one cares anymore, because everything can multitask. That's what the cloud's going to be. It's going to be the multitasking of the future. Yeah, it's there. So what? Big deal.
No, cloud is going to be a marketing buzzword and nothing more than that.
You know what Derek of the old podcast said? He said that nothing's going to impress him until holograms. He wants holograms, actual holograms. If it doesn't have holograms, he's not going to be impressed.
I want to I want a console with a built-in 3D printer.
Ooh, I want a 3D printer too. Just if I become rich, that's the first thing I'm buying, in fact. You know, I want a 3D printer, and I want to make my own little statues.
I think that would be very cool.
And by the way, that's
you unlock an achievement and it prints a 3D statue for you.
World of Warcraft,
in
World of Warcraft, they actually allow you to have a 3D model of the of your favorite character. And
yeah, there is a company that will do that for you. Yes.
Yeah, but the thing is that World of Warcraft, if you already own a 3D printer, they'll just send you the model and you can print it out yourself. You know, that's
nice.
So yeah, I mean, I wonder when 3D printers will be like getting a laser printer now. I mean, laser printers aren't, you know, they're still expensive, but they're not like prohibitively expensive. I mean,
the toner is more expensive than the laser printer.
But I'm just wondering, at what point do 3D printers become the laser printers? You know, it's sort of like mildly expensive, but you can afford it if you really want
it. It will happen in 7 years.
Ooh, okay. Well, I have something to live for.
Yeah,
we can skip his question because he already answered that one.
Yeah, you can take Arthur the Fifth, right?
May I?
Yeah.
Okay. From Arthur the Fifth, Microsoft getting some sense. Microsoft points were a barrier to many people I know. Awkward, unspendable amounts, having to buy more points than needed. Not to mention that the game is £7. It looks more cost effective than a game that is 8 Microsoft points, equivalent prices. I'm just glad they're gone. Just have to cash in my codes and good riddance. Gamers can return digital items on Origin after a week. What's Origin? So not a fan of Origin. At Bungie's Destiny, I am really looking forward to it. I have great respect for Bungie. Destiny is an ambitious project. However, I can't speculate on whether it'll outshine Halo, let alone Star Wars. So far, it looks like a Halo MMO FPS. Prove me wrong, Bungie.
I was amazed that there was no presence for Destiny at PAX Prime at all.
Well, I mean, it's Bungie. I mean,
yeah.
You know. But here's the thing is that if you played Halo 3 ODST, there was actually a poster for Destiny. Back
in
2007, yeah. So they were teasing that thing a long time ago. So which tells me that Destiny does take place in the Marathon Halo universe. We just have to figure out which part of it. Which is strange because the entire plot of Destiny is that this giant ball protected the Earth from being wiped out by aliens. But hey, but maybe it takes place long after Halo.
I don't know. It looks amazing. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. At Borderlands coming to the PlayStation Vita. What's the PlayStation Vita? Is it somehow related to Origin? Ouch. At Sony Microsoft announces launch titles, lineup, window. The internet has no clue either. I have pre-ordered a PS4 because by the time the Xbox comes out in Europe, my exam period will start and I have no time. Oh, yeah. You know, that's what happens when you grow older to all the younger listeners. You know, it's not that you can't afford stuff. It's that you don't have any time for stuff, you know?
Yep. Very true.
Yeah. The lineup is impressive, but it doesn't make that much difference. In the end, launch titles are pointless. Look, that's not true. Well, we'll sell the console the exclusives, which will come out much later in the console cycle. By the time Halo 5 comes out, I'll probably own both consoles. So now I'm going with the cheaper one that comes out earlier. Okay, in Europe, yeah. But here's the problem. You better pre-order the PS4 because from what I understand, there's going to be massive shortages of the PS4. And people may actually go to the Xbox One because the PS4 isn't there. You know, by then maybe get tired of waiting. I have an extra 100 in my pocket. I might as well.
Then the rumor is that the Xbox One is going to be out a week ahead of the PS4 in the United States. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, here's the thing. We have conflicting reports because the Doritos contest says that it's going to be in late November. So we have two different things. I'm more willing to incline that the Xbox One is going to come out on November 8th. But, you know. Like I said, I'm surprised they're not coming out on November 1st because that would be 1-1-1, you know, or 1-1-1. A lot of ones there.
Too
bad they didn't have their launch in 2011 because then they could really go hog wild. We're going to launch on November 11th, 2011. 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1- gamer. I practically own every console that came out in the past 10 years, minus the PS Vita, which sucks. I don't know if he's saying that the Vita sucks or that the fact he doesn't own a Vita sucks. What?
The Vita is actually very nice hardware. It's just that there aren't any games.
Well, at least you can run through all the games that it has in a short period of time.
Yep.
I have a laptop, but it has crap specs. Much like Powell, I stopped chasing performance as it is it's a very expensive business, especially if you're not a techie. I still have 100 or so games on my Steam account, Bloody Sales, which I sometimes play. Yeah, I started getting trapped into those Humble Bundles now. Get 10 games for $5. Now, how can I not resist that? Especially if it's on Steam or Origin, because you don't even have to download them. They're just there that you own, and when you want them, you can download them. So I started playing Mirror's Edge on my PC, and I discovered I cannot play it with a keyboard and mouse, so I hooked up my 360 controller. And one of the best things about games, PC games, is that it, when you put in a 360 controller, oh, look, it turns into a 360. In the terms of, you see the A, B, C, A, B, X, Y buttons and all that stuff, it's like it suddenly turned into a glorified 360, right? So, you know, this week's weekly sale is Paradox, the Paradox games. And I asked Alan about it, and he said, no, I already own all these. And my response is, you know what? You know that you can buy this for $6 and then just gift those codes to people and make a lot of friends that way.
Right.
You know, and there's like 10 games that you can buy for $6.
That would require Alan to have friends, so.
Ouch. Okay. So we're going to move on to gaming history. And, you know, we teased this last week about Chrome Owls. And if you're an Amiga owner, I mean, chiefly, I mean, they did other games for other platforms, but it's the Amiga for which they're best known, at least in my eyes. So take it away, Jordan.
I hope we get this one right, because this is our third attempt at recording this. So we have recording going. Everything is going okay.
It's the second attempt, and it recorded fine last week. It was just too late. And last week, we just ran out of time.
Okay. Gaming history, Psygnosis. Founded by Jonathan Ellis, Ian Hetherington, and David Lawson, the Liverpool-based Psygnosis was indirectly born from the ashes of the defunct 8-bit game company Imagine Software, where Lawson was one of the founders and Hetherington was financial director. After the collapse of Imagine in 1984, the name and trademarks were bought by Ocean Software, while the rights of the software remained with the original copyright owners. After Imagine, Lawson and Hetherington set up a new company called Finch Speed, which took two unfinished games developed by Imagine, Bandersnatch for the ZX Spectrum and Cyclaps for the Commodore 64, and fused them into one to become Bratikos, the first game published by Psygnosis. Psygnosis produced only one title in 1986 called Deep Space, a complex, difficult space exploration game. The box artwork was very distinctive, with a black background and fantasy artwork bordered in red. This style was maintained for the best part of 10 years, with the Psygnosis game being easily identifiable on a shelf of miscellaneous games. For the next few years, Psygnosis's releases contained increasingly improved graphics, but were marred by similarly difficult gameplay and control methods. The original company headquarters were located at the Port of Liverpool building at the Pierhead in Liverpool, but soon moved to Century Buildings in Brunswick Business Park, also in Liverpool, and later moved down the road 200 meters to the South Harrington building and South Harrington dock. Though Psygnosis primarily became a game publisher, some games were developed fully or partly in-house. During the early days, artists were employed full-time at the headquarters, offering third-party developers, who were often just single programmers, a very high-quality art resource. This had the result of allowing Psygnosis to maintain very high graphical standards across the board, something for which the company became most famous. The original artists were Garvin Corbett, Jeff Barnfit, Colin Rushby, and Jim Bowers, with Neil Thompson joining a little later. Closely following in the path of 1987 hit Barbarian, with what was becoming a trademark high-quality introduction, Obliterator, released in 1988, contained an opening animation by Jim Bowers, now a digital matte painter for the movie industry, with the main character looking directly at the camera. His face is animated with bewilderment that turns into anger, at which point he drops his guns and shoots at the observer. This short scene would further pave the way for many increasingly sophisticated intro animations, starting with 2D hand-drawn sequences and then progressing into full motion video and 3D rendered movies created with Sculpt 4D on the Amiga. Eventually, Psygnosis would buy many Silicon Graphics workstations for the sole purpose of creating these animations. While most game companies of the mid to late 1980s, including Psygnosis, were releasing identical games on both the Amiga and Atari ST, Psygnosis started to use the full potential of the Amiga's more powerful hardware to produce technically stunning games. It was these technically superior titles that brought the company its early success, with the landmark title Shadow of the Beast bringing the company its greatest success so far in 1989. Its multi-layered, parallax scrolling, and stunning music were highly advanced at the time, and as such, led to the game being used as a showcase demonstration for the Amiga in many computer shops.
I remember that, actually. I do remember demo Amigas, and Shadow of the Beast was demoing in front of it. I do remember that.
Yeah, I actually own the original copy of Shadow of the Beast.
Oh, I did too. I'm just remembering it being in store shops, you know, with Shadow of the Beast running.
Yeah. Later, Psygnosis consolidated its fame after publishing the DMA Digidesign Lemmings game franchise. Debuting in 1991 on the Amiga, Lemmings was soon to be ported to a plethora of different computer and video game platforms, generating many sequels and variations of its concept through the years.
Now, when you said plethora, all of a sudden I was thinking about Three Amigos. Would you say I have a plethora of gifts?
After that, Psygnosis put unparalleled effort in producing Microcosm, a game that debuted on Japanese system FM Towns and was soon to become a technical showcase and flagship title for new Commodore CD32 and SMSG 3DO multimedia consoles. Although gameplay was never considered on par with technical aspects, graphics and music by Rick Wakeman and long FMV introduction were among the finest in company history at the time. Phil Morris was music manager from 1992 to 1998 in Liverpool and chose the Rick Wakeman music tracks and tracks by Steve Vai and Joe Satriani, both Sony artists at the time, for PlayStation F1 game. Microcosm was probably the first CD-ROM game by Psygnosis to feature voice recordings produced and directed in London by Phil Morris with Canadian voice actor Carrie Shale of the Sound Company. Psygnosis also received top billing for creating face-off games in the Nickelodeon 1992 television show Nick Arcade, with such games as Post Haste, Jet Jocks, and Battle of the Bands, among others. In 1993, the company was acquired by Sony Electronic Publishing in preparation for the September 1995 introduction of Sony's PlayStation console in Western markets. Psygnosis started creating games using the PlayStation as a primary reference hardware. Among the most famous creations of this period were Wipeout, G-Police, and the Colony Wars series. Oh, Colony Wars was awesome. Some of which were ported to PC and other platforms. In 2001, the studio was renamed SCE Liverpool, where it developed Wipeout Fusion, Wipeout Pure for the PlayStation Portable, and Wipeout Pulse for the PSP and PS2. The studio was closed in 2012.
By the way, one thing that we forgot to mention is we're talking about that Chrome Owl, right? That was actually designed by Roger Dean.
The Chrome Owl was awesome, and Shadow of the Beast and Shadow of the Beast 2 were both excellent games, and I'm so excited to see Shadow of the Beast coming back.
Can you say anything about Lemmings? I mean, it started.
Lemmings isn't another one that was ported to everything. I mean, everybody should be aware of Lemmings. If you're not aware of Lemmings, there's something wrong with you.
Lemmings was the start of an entire new genre. Although, Gyromite, maybe. I mean, Gyromite.
Lemmings was to the 1990s what Tetris was to the 1980s.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, it was always funny to watch them self-destruct because they would just...
Oh, no! Pop!
They would just go... Before that, they would clutch their heads and say, we're going to die.
Oh, no!
Yeah, I mean,
and then they go pop. All of the Psygnosis stuff is very good, very difficult games, but very good. They had another one that was kind of reminiscent of the Ed 209 from RoboCop, stomping around shooting stuff. I can't remember the name of that one. That was very good too.
Yeah,
that was around the same time as Shadow of the Beast.
I just remember when I got Barbarian. It was one of the early games, and the character was so tall. You know, I was like, wow. I mean, you know, it was mind blowing because if you played an arcade game, you know, most of the characters that you played were these short little things in the middle of the game. You know, sort of like Mario height, but in Barbarian, it was sort of like tall and, you know, and filled like one third of the screen, that sort of thing. By the way, the name of the game with the Ed 209 was Walker.
Walker. I remember playing Barbarian at a friend's house, and his kid was playing Barbarian, and all of a sudden we heard this shriek, and he dropped the controller, and he went, "Oh my God, I cut off his head!" And there was like blood squirting on the screen. It actually traumatized a child. It was, that graphic in that.
Yay.
And of course, nowadays it'd be nothing, but yeah.
Yay, we traumatized kids. The only thing Psygnosis traumatized me with was the difficulty of the gameplay, because that was one of the hardest things. And I always threw my controller in disgust, only to pick it up and try again. Because, you know, when you're a kid, you know, it's very hard to frustrate you into not playing. It's sort of like a challenge that you want to. Anyway, the question of the week is related to the 2DS. The question of the week is, how many times have you purchased a new form factor of a console that you've already owned? So, you know, it's like going from the PlayStation 1 to the Slim to I forgot what they called it. The smallest PS1 they had. What did they call it again?
It was the PS1, but they spelled out one, O-N-E. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So how many times have you purchased a new form factor of a console that you already owned?
Zero. Never done it.
You never gone from... I can't believe that you still have... Oh, you always have the launch titles, huh?
either the launch titles or, you know, I wait. Like with the 3DS, I did not buy the fat 3DS. I waited for the 3DS Slim. The original fat 3DS looked too much like something designed out of Soviet Russia, so I passed on it and got the regular 3DS.
I actually went from an Amiga 1000 to an Amiga 500.
Wow.
And the thing is, I don't recall how I ever was able to afford it. I guess my brother bought it for me.
I don't consider going from the 1000 to 500 to be a
are you kidding me?
A model change.
No, Do you know how slow the Amiga 1000 was?
That's what I'm saying is that the 500 was a completely different machine from the 1000.
But it was still the same form function though. I mean, it was, you know, oh, the other thing is you didn't have the Kickstarter disc.
You didn't have the Kickstarter discs, and yeah, exactly.
You didn't have the you had two discs when you were using the 1000, the Kickstarter and the one that had the OS on it.
Right, right.
And this one, you only had the OS, you know.
Right. The rest of it was on the ROM inside.
Yeah, so, but I consider it that. I mean, I went from I never changed a Nintendo console. I only had one of each thing. And I'm trying to think of anything else I might have gone from. I can't count getting the Atari expansion for the ColecoVision.
No, huh?
But, you know, I mean, by the way, we can't include PCs because people get new PCs all the time. That's
like, exactly.
Actually, if I get a, I don't know if it's going to happen now, but if I get a 360, the Slim 360, that would not the new one that they just released. I'm talking about the one in between, you know.
Right, right.
If I get that, I guess that'll be a new form for me, you know. But with the Xbox One so close, I don't think there's any point for me to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I might end up, if Microsoft announces a Surface 2 next year at some sort of reasonable price point, maybe I'll upgrade to a Surface 2. I don't know.
I'm not going to include that because I went from an iPhone 3 to an iPhone 4. I cannot count that either. I'm talking about consoles here.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I can't think of any console that I went out and bought because I keep the original in working condition. So why would I buy a
smaller? That's the only thing I can think of. I mean, the example I gave with the PS1, the main strength of it was that it was a lot smaller and portable. You know, you could take it around with people, you know, that was.
Or unlike the PS2 and the PS2 Slim came out, you couldn't put a hard drive in it.
Yeah. Wasn't there problems with using some PS1 games with the latest PS1 machine that they just simply wouldn't work?
I don't remember that.
Oh. Anyway, look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net along with industry news. Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast or the forums at GamingPodcast.net/forum or send us your comments to fans@GamingPodcast.net. You can also check out our gaming news at GameStudios.com. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us some iTunes comments.
Yay, iTunes comments.
So, yeah. I asked Dan if he wanted to do tonight, but he said that school is just starting, so he couldn't. Because he's a
teacher. Yeah, it's that time of year.
Yeah. And Paul is still on the crunch. Hopefully he'll be done with that soon because we need a third. I mean,
hopefully Paul will be done with the crunch and still have a job at the end. That would be nice.
Yeah, but you know, the entire point of doing this crunch is, I guess, to make enough money that, you know, you could cruise for a while you're looking for another job that isn't crunchy. You know, I actually got a big fat check for my last work on a film because I did 2 hours of overtime and 4 hours of double overtime and wet work. So you get extra pay if you get wet because of rain.
Nice.
So that'll prevent me from starving for a little bit longer.
Ka-ching. More money.
We'll see you next week.
Good night, everybody.